You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Hamid.
Hi, love.
How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
You know, I can't complain. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. And I encourage everyone to listen to it, to subscribe to the newsletter. It's free, although if you want to hear the second half of this conversation and all my conversations, it helps to become a paid subscriber, which I also encourage. And you, more importantly, are Hamid Reza Azizi. You are now a visiting fellow at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. But some years ago, I guess up until around 2020 or so, you taught at Shahid Beheshti University, which I've just mispronounced, I'm sure, in Tehran. And you were a guest lecturer at the Department of Regional Studies at the University of Tehran. Now, the timing for this is good. I'm really looking forward to this. You've got a book just coming out. In fact, it's out in the UK and Europe, and will be out in a few weeks in the US. And it's never too soon to pre-order. And it's called The Axis of Resistance, Iran, Israel, and the Struggle for the Middle East. And, you know, you've also become a little bit of a star on Twitter. This happens with wars, I've noticed, that, you know, suddenly some regional expert is catapulted to a higher platform in front of a wider audience. In this case, this has happened, I would say, with you and with this is Israeli analyst Satrinowicz. I encourage people to follow both of you on Twitter. So my main goal in this conversation is to get a clearer sense for the character of the Iranian regime as it exists now. And that involves two things: understanding the ways it's different from the pre-war Iranian regime, whose leader, of course, was killed by the U.S. and Israel, and other prominent members of it were killed. But also to understand what continuity there is, over that period of time. And to some extent, going back to the revolution, what continuity there is going back to the revolution, and how the character evolved since then in response to events. I hope to, in particular, shed light on a question that Americans may have if they've been following the Iran issue for some time, which is kind of which characterization of the regime to accept. In America, you know, pretty much everyone agrees that it's a regime and has agreed for some time that has an ideological element that is significant. But still, on the one hand, you have people who say still you just treat it basically as a rational actor that's focusing on Iran's national security. In other words, basically a realist kind of analysis. Other people are put more emphasis on the ideology, including the religious part of the ideology. In fact, I'd say the more hawkish the people, the more inclined they are to emphasize the religious character as a rule, including the kind of religious fervor. At the extreme end, you get people saying, these people are suicidally apocalyptic. That's why they can't afford to have, we can't let them at all costs have a nuclear weapon, because they'd be happy to die in a Holocaust so long as Israel was destroyed and so on. So there's a whole spectrum of characterizations of the regime. And I hope by the end of this to have a much clearer way of thinking about what we can expect from it. Before we get into any of that, I would ask you to say a little more about your background, including, if you will, letting us know why you haven't been back to Iran in, what is it now, 6 or 7 years? Is that right?
Yeah, sure. First of all, thank you so much for having me on this podcast. And I look forward to discussing with you all these issues as much as we can, because it's a kind of a long story. Mm-hmm. We have to try and do our best to keep it as concise as possible. So you mentioned correctly that I was a lecturer at the Shahid Beheshti University, which is formerly called National University of Iran. So before the revolution, I mean, speaking of the revolution, that was one of the changes, right, versus continuity. University of Tehran, the other affiliation that I had, remained the same in terms of the name, but the national university change. I did my education there. I received my PhD in the field of regional studies, international relations from the University of Tehran. Then for a few years, I was a lecturer there. And I left Iran in 2019 to start a postdoc here, working on Iranian foreign policy in the Middle East with a focus on Syria and Iraq back then. My work was mostly focused on Iranian strategy in Syria. It was at the somehow peak of the Syrian war still. And so since I left, there have been quite a few developments, as you know. So we had the election of Ebrahim Raisi as the president in 2021. And I was effectively fired from the university, you know, shortly after leaving the country because, you know, for them, for whatever reason, it wasn't quite acceptable for someone like me, a young professional, to leave the country for a longer time. So they would be okay with a few months, but I had the opportunity of being here for 2 years. So that was one of the reasons. Then the political atmosphere changed. I started to be vocal here and there in the media about especially the protest movements, first the Woman Life Freedom Movement, and then, you know, the other rounds that followed. So this automatically, you know, puts you under the spotlight and makes it difficult to think of returning to the country, given all the complications. So, yeah, now here I am now after 7 years in Germany, still working with the same institute. But my focus has broadened a little bit to also concentrate on Iranian elite dynamics, as you know, also a little bit more background on the Iranian regional policy, the axis of resistance, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I gather you don't expect to be going back to Iran unless there's a dramatic change in the character of the government.
Yes, we can put it like that, which unfortunately I don't expect to be the case anytime soon. I mean, speaking of a change in the system, and I know that President Trump likes to speak of what has happened in Iran since the war as a regime change, which is not the, you know, a quite correct way of characterization. There has been a transformation in the type of the regime, but it has actually hardened, not softened, especially its security stance. You know, that's the current situation, actually, in a way.
Okay. So why don't we start kind of early in the relatively speaking in the history of Iran. What I'd like to do, there are two things about Iran. One is hostility toward the U.S. One is hostility toward Israel. I understand, or as they would put it, toward the Zionist regime in Israel. I understand, I think, the American part of the hostility better, possibly because I'm an American and I've focused on that. Let me give you very quickly my understanding of some important ingredients in that. And then maybe you can comment on what I've gotten wrong or right, and then talk more about that, and especially about the source of antagonism toward Israel. Okay, so America, of course, you know, pretty famously now, I think we helped we supported a coup in 1953 that deposed a democratically elected leader, installed the Shah of Iran, who was, you know, a somewhat authoritarian dictator, and the Iranian Revolution of 1979 was focused on deposing him. So naturally, there was, you know, tension between America and the emerging regime in Iran on those grounds alone. I mean, I think a number of people would call him a brutal dictator. Then, as soon as he was deposed, the U.S. gave him sanctuary against Jimmy Carter's better judgment, actually. He came here to be treated for cancer or something. And this was one of the grievances of the, I don't know, they called them students at the time, but whoever was holding hostages at the U.S. embassy, they wanted him released. So that was an issue. Now, after, then there was the Iraq War Iraq attacked Iran. It was a very traumatic, long war. The U.S. supported Iraq. They gave it intelligence, including, I think, targeting information. I gather they provided some of the precursors or some kind of something that helped Iraq develop chemical weapons that were used. So obviously at the end of that, around 1988 or whatever, the Iranian regime was not all that favorably disposed to the U.S. And I think all that helps explain, I'm skipping a lot, but I think all this helps explain why when the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, that was profoundly threatening to Iran. Now, and of course, Iran famously mobilized, helped cultivate these sympathetic Shia militias who attacked some Americans. But even separate from that, they had a, remember, Iran still at this point considered Iraq a big enemy. In fact, I gather that that's when they first started the nuclear weapons program that, so far as I know, was abandoned in 2003. They were thinking about deterring Iraq. That was not about Israel. And that was also some of the reason for cultivating the Shia militias in Iraq. But in any event, you know, when we invaded Iraq, having just declared Iran a member of the Axis of Evil, this didn't do anything to help relations with us. And of course, since then, we have, given America's close relationship to Israel, we've done a number of things that Iran didn't like, most notably recently attacking them twice in June of last year now. So anyway, I kind of get a certain amount of American hostility. I mean, and I gather that by the time the revolution even happened, this was a big talking point for the regime, hostility toward America. Now, the Israeli side of it, I know less about. So I guess I'd at this point stop talking finally and let you comment on anything I've said, add to it, and then get into the question of how Israel has joined, well, I don't even know which came first, but how it came to be that both Israel and America are kind of the great Satans.
Yeah, sure. There's a lot to unpack here, of course. Just let me say something about what you mentioned about Iraq. Actually, after the first Gulf War in 1991, mm-hmm. The significance of Iraq and the Saddam regime as kind of the arch enemy of the Islamic Republic somehow reduced. And that was actually the time. So in terms of, you know, kind of where our starting point should be. In a way, and this is something that few people know or talk about, in a way, the first Gulf War, the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 1991 helped Iran in the sense that after the ceasefire between Iran and Iraq in 1988, some of the Iranian territory toward the west border areas were still under control of Iraq. So it was a ceasefire that Iran was forced to accept because the United States had intervened directly and so on. It was only during the U.S. invasion that Iraq, in order to concentrate on the center, they pulled their forces back and handed over the territory back to Iran. And not only that, but they also brought some of their fighter jets to Iran in order to keep them immune from the U.S. attacks, some of which, there are rumors that Iran never gave them back. So this is also a kind of less discussed context that is needed. And then, of course, in 2003, what the U.S. did with this invasion, and when looking at it in a longer term perspective, it was intensifying and deepening the Islamic Republic's influence in the country.
And could I inject just one thing that's related to the point you just added? There was a period of seeming rapprochement that went up to 2003, because Iran actually helped us prepare the ground for the invasion of Afghanistan, right? Absolutely. They were helping us out. I've even heard that Soleimani whom we later killed, went to Afghanistan and helped prepare the ground. And then, like, almost immediately, we declared Iran a member of the Axis of Evil, like not long after they did this. But anyway, so there was this moment where there was seemingly the possibility for other things, as maybe there was after the Obama's nuclear deal. But anyway, I'll stop there. Go ahead.
No, that's a very good point, actually, because that also has to do with these longstanding grievances and mistrust between Iran and the United States, because, you know, people, especially under the influence of social media, I guess, you know, people tend to read less history books than they ever did maybe in the past. They tend to focus maybe on the only on the past 1 or 2 years, and then they don't see these kind of efforts, mutual efforts at some point. You know, we had also, you know, eras, periods where the United States wanted to initiate a rapprochement, and those mistrusts. I mean, it's been a kind of a vicious circle in a way. But you're absolutely right. In Afghanistan, Iran actually helped the United States because they saw at the time Taliban as their own enemy as well. There was a time around 1997, if I'm not mistaken, or 96, around that time when the Iranian diplomats and consulate staff were killed by the Taliban, and Iran almost entered into a war against the group. It was only the intervention of Hassan Rouhani and then Khamenei himself who basically, you know, decided last minute not to do that. Anyway, so this is also an important context. But speaking of the U.S. versus Israel, how they are framed in the context of the Islamic Republic, I think here another context is needed, and that's about the Islamic Revolution itself. So the 1979 revolution, which we know as the Islamic Revolution, which it wasn't only Islamic, right? There was a coalition of actors that contributed to the revolution, and some argued that the role that some leftist groups at the time played in the revolution, especially those with the background in, you know, guerrilla operations, you know, sort of urban warfare and so on, which contributed a lot to the victory of the revolution, especially in the later stages. And those groups also played an important role. Then we had also the Nationalist Front, which was kind of the remnants and sort of reconfigured setting of the Nationalist Front that Mohammad Mossadegh, the prime minister who was ousted by the U.S. Initiated coup, he had established. So these groups also had a role. In a way, immediately after the revolution, the Islamists, and because, of course, the leader of the revolution was a cleric who around whom, you know, all these groups had somehow gathered, it became somehow Islamic, and there was a purge of the leftists and liberals and all those other groups. So why I'm mentioning this background, because that's exactly where the issue of Israel and also the support for Palestine come to the forefront. So it wasn't only a matter of, for example, Islamic unity, as you know, explained by Khomeini, Ruhollah Khomeini, the first supreme leader of the Islamic Republic, for example. It also had to do with this very strong leftist support for Palestine at the moment, which also impacted quite clearly and deeply some revolutionary Iranian groups as well. For example, some of the Iranian revolutionaries, especially those affiliated with this organization called Mujahideen-e-Khalq, MEK, which then became an opposition group and started armed activities against the Islamic Republic itself. Those were actually trained by the PLO, by the Palestinian militias in southern Lebanon. And that was how basically at the time, the kind of, how to say, this exchange of military expertise and knowledge and so on. It was the other way around. So the Palestinians were helping that. So it was a mixture of anti-colonialism, seeing Israel as they describe it, both the leftists and then increasingly the Islamists, as a colonial project. So it was partly anti-colonialism, partly about Islamic unity, and partly about this kind of pragmatic relationship somehow, or better to say operational relationship, that had been forged and formed over decades between the Iranian revolutionaries and these groups. So this is the way that we should understand this whole phenomenon when it comes to Israel, actually.
Right. Because, you know, as things develop and Iran builds this so-called axis of resistance, you know, it includes some kind of disparate elements. You've got the Shia Hezbollah, but you've also got the Sunni Hamas. And like, what do they have in common? They don't like Israel. And so it's natural for Iran to, you know, certainly sustain, if not amplify, that theme. And also to broadly gather sympathy within the Middle East, because so many Arab leaders are thought of by some Arabs as not really caring much about the Palestinians and not really being having sufficient enmity toward Israel. And I want to like distinguish that from any extent to which the hostility toward Israel may have to do with Islam per se. I mean, you started out talking about the Islamic character of the revolution. I'd like to drill down on that a little more, because, again, in the modern history of Middle East antagonism, it's like Arabs, not Persians, who had the original grievance with Israel. And I think a lot of, especially younger people, don't understand the extent to which it used to be thought of as an Israeli-Arab conflict, or maybe an Arab versus Jew conflict, but not a religious conflict. And it wasn't really very religious in character. It has become more that way. But anyway, the point is, originally, Iran per se had no big issue in that sense, along that dimension, with Israel. And, you know, nobody took land from Iran to start Israel. And as for the Islamic character of the regime, you know, I'd like you to talk about that a little more, because, you know, if you look at the Quran, you can certainly find anti-Jewish passages. On the other hand, you can find these, you know, tributes to Moses. And you know, my sense from just looking at the Quran is that Muhammad was actually trying to build a coalition of Jews and Christians and others. And when that was working out, he was saying very nice things. And when it wasn't working out, he wasn't. And all of that was kind of captured in the Quran. But in any event, my point is that it's not like you would read the Quran and come away with this unambiguous hostility toward Jews or Israel, right? As being built into the religion. Now, there is this whole thing about jihad and infidels, but they are, you know, Jews, like Christians, are people of the book. They get a certain kind of special dispensation in Islamic law, you know. So talk a little. I took you to be saying that the Islamic character of the regime of the revolution had a certain amount to do with the hostility to Israel. And I guess I'd like you to just elaborate on that.
Yeah, of course. I'm not an expert on religion. I must say that I have read the Quran, of course, and you are right about, passages being there about the hostility with the Jews. But it's also about, because these are kind of context oriented, right? They have to be understood in the context of the time that they were explained by Muhammad. In some instances, you see, for example, hostility towards Christian as well, or you see mm-hmm. hostility towards some words about, you know, those people who pretend to be Muslims but are acting otherwise, something that they call munafiqin. So what I want to say is that the text itself, the religion itself, is very much like, you know, any other religion, is very much open to interpretation. So when I said that it has to do with the Islamic nature of, or the Islamist nature of the government, I have a distinction in mind between Islam and Islamism, you know, because Islam is a religion, but Islamism is an ideology, and it has actually a lot of shapes and forms. like the form that you know eventually prevailed in Iran was a very much Shia based you know sort of a version of Islamism, which in so many respects is at odds with the Sunni version of Islamism, you know, that kind of Salafi jihadi explanation of that. So that was actually why I mentioned that kind of mixed nature of the revolution, because this is actually a criticism, you know. Looking back, some people who explored the roots and also the implications of the revolution, they speak, for example, of certain intellectuals like Ali Shariati, how those people basically instrumentalized religion, mixed it with the leftist and especially Marxist narrative, which was quite you know popular at the time, in order to get as many people as possible on board in the fight against the United States. Like the way that he describes the character of the Shia imams, you know, like Ali, like Hussein, the way that he try to connect, for example, someone like Abu Zar, who was, you know, very someone very close to Prophet Muhammad, to the idea of opposing tyranny, for example. You know, these sorts of things. So it's all about the interpretation, and within that interpretation, we can speak about the role of the United States and the role of the Israel. So. When it comes to the United States, as you also, you know, clearly mentioned, it has to do with the history. But then they see themselves, you know, this is very important. It has to do actually with the perception, a perception which is the result of all these ideologies and historical experiences and traumas and everything. So the perception is that this country has been ruled by a tyrant, which was backed by the United States. So that was the U.S. Project, right? And mm-hmm. now that we have managed to get rid of this, now that we have managed to get rid of the U.S. dominance, it is our duty, it is our task to help other nations who are suffering more or less in a similar way around the region, and not only that, around the world, also to liberate themselves from the United States. And to them, the clearest manifestation of this is Israel. Which again, as I said, they see this as an entity which was based, which was founded by Britain and then supported by the United States in order to facilitate the dominance of the hegemons of the time, the Western hegemons of the time on the region. So in that sense, because it evolved over time, they didn't see Israel as an actor, you know, having sufficient agency in itself that would, you know, result this sort of hostility. They saw it as the expansion of the U.S. role and the kind of colonial role in the region, and that, you know, resulted in the sort of a kind of support for Palestine that we saw. But here, what's important also to emphasize is that it wasn't confined to the issue of Israel. There was this concept called exporting the revolution, which mm-hmm. was clearly mentioned and also supported in different ways by Khomeini himself, especially the kind of hardline revolutionaries of the late 1970s and early 1980s, those who ironically later became reformists in the country and became liberal. They also fervently supported this idea of also, you know, helping those other Muslim nations in the region, like in the countries of the Persian Gulf, in Iraq itself, you know, to liberate themselves from their own tyrants. And that was one of the reasons, not the only reason, one of the reasons that provoked the Iran-Iraq war. Iraq, Saddam himself had long-standing plans for that invasion, but that was maybe one of the last triggers that caused the war to happen eventually.
So this is just a footnote, but to some extent, Saddam's attack on Iran was itself, in his mind, to some extent, defensively motivated. Because, I mean, this is such a big theme in history, and I want to, in current affairs, it just seems to almost always be the case that people, nations perceived as aggressors and even that commit aggression in their own minds are often committing more of a defensive act than they are perceived as committing. And I think this is, we'll get back to the extent to which this is true of Iran itself. I think it's underappreciated by many in America, the extent to which Iran sees a lot of what is taken as offensive and in terms of its use of these so-called proxies. I know that's a term you have some issues with, but they see that as kind of pure offense. And I think you'll agree that to some extent, that's actually not the way Iran is thinking about it. Anyway, we'll get back to that. But honestly, I hadn't really thought much about Saddam Hussein's motivation in invading Iran. But you're saying that in his mind, that was a national security measure to some extent.
Yeah, it was. I mean, because look, there were instances in the first months and basically the first year after the revolution where some clerics, also some officials, spoke openly about the, need for the Iraqi people to rise up against Saddam, for example. And look, at the end of the day, even in the absence of any deliberate project on the Iranian side, because of the organic ties between the Iraqi and Iranian Shias, and the very fact that Khomeini, before going to France and then returning back to Tehran, spend many years in exile in Najaf in Iraq, and had a lot of contacts, also followers among the Iraqi Shias, also political factions. So that was an alarm bell, for Saddam. The hostility between Iran and Iraq was there, of course, for many years. And just a few days before the start of the war, we had there was this agreement between the Shah and Saddam over delineation of Arvand River, which was perceived by Saddam as very much one-sided, and that was another issue. He wanted to basically fix that. So yeah, as you rightly said, there's a lot of motivations that leaders and countries have in mind when think of offense or defense. And the same is the case, regarding the current conflict. What is perceived by the Iranian side as a full-scale aggression is seen differently by many people in Israel. So it really depends on the kind of lens that you apply in studying or thinking about these different developments, actually.
Right. And it absolutely is the case that Israelis, more than a lot of Americans realize, consider what looks to be pretty aggressive behavior, especially since October 7th, to be defensively motivated. I mean, that's actually the governing conviction. And the idea, I think broadly, the idea is, look, everyone hates us. They're always going to hate us. We just have to incapacitate the neighboring states so that they don't have the capacity to act on the hatred. Now, with Iran specifically, Israel has a kind of a narrower rationale, which is to say, as we said, the Iranian regime has since the revolution kind of singled out Israel. I mean, it's very interesting what you say, that that's been to some considerable extent, because Israel is seen as an American tool, since lately in America, the perception has been the opposite. But in any event, among some people, since this war especially. But this is, a big concern in Israel. And they'll say, look, they keep saying they want to wipe us off the map. The reply to that from, I think, traditionally even from the regime is, first of all, the wipe them off the map, quote, strictly speaking, the translation was more like, the Zionist regime or the regime that occupies Jerusalem must pass from the pages of time or something. So in other words, It's about the regime, not the people of Israel. We don't plan to kill all the people in Israel. And I think that's what leaders in Iran, when pressed, have actually said, right? We want regime change. And of course, that's what Israel says about Iran now. In that sense, I guess there's kind of symmetry. But at the same time, first of all, the Israeli regime, like most regimes, is not enthusiastic about regime change. And the Israeli people might well imagine that, look, once Iran changes the regime, they're obviously going to gratify all of the Arabs on whose behalf they have spoken, right? So they're going to be in favor of right of return, letting the Palestinians come back. How much room does that leave for us? And so on. Anyway, the big question I'm getting at is, to what extent is, I mean, to what extent Israel considers Iran an inherently existential threat? My own view is that to the extent that it is that, it's gotten closer and closer to that as a result of some things that both Israel and America have done. But to what extent is that a well-founded concern? And in what sense is it existential? You know, existential to the regime, existential to the people, or what?
Well, now we are at a situation that both sides see, the other as an existential threat. And this cycle of violence and escalation, and especially this latest war, has brought us to the point that I think, both can verifiably claim that the other side is after the destruction of the other. And not just the regime, but maybe also the people. I mean, this is the case about what Israelis have not just said, but also done in targeting the Iranian infrastructure, and also more or less the same about, Iranian attacks on civilian areas in Israel. So, but, the way that we can maybe a little bit better analyze this is, again, to go a little bit back in the history and look how it evolves and how it develops. One thing that, again, is usually ignored or maybe probably not understood at all is that even after the Islamic Revolution and during the 8 years of Iran-Iraq war, Israel still didn't see Iran as an existential threat, or maybe mm-hmm. Among the top three threats to its security. There are historical accounts, and this is something I have also mentioned in my book briefly, that at some point during the war, the Israelis, through intermediaries, actually sold arms to the Islamic Republic. And this was something that is quite, interesting, right? When we look at this, why? Mm-hmm. Because at the time, Saddam and his regime was the main threat to Israel. You know, the way that he claimed to be the sort of leader of the Arab world. Before him, it was Jamal Abdel Nasser, right? So it's about in one way, we can see it as inherently a battle over a regional hegemony in the first place, and then, which is, of course, also motivated to some extent or mixed with ideological or nationalist or, religious elements as well. So in the case of Abdel Nasser, in the case of Saddam, it was mostly about Arab nationalism. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Iran, it's mostly about the Shia Islamist ideology, right? But in the end, what all these actors did when they saw the situation as favorable and ripe was to try to use that ideology again, whether nationalism or Islamism or whatever, in order to project their influence in the region, right? So as long as Saddam was there, and as long as this hot or cold war between the Islamic Republic and Iraq was ongoing somehow, There was a sort of a balance. None of them could sort of a, you know, really claim to have the upper hand. But what happened actually after 2003, after the fall of Saddam, and then with the developments of the Arab Spring, Iranian intervention in Syria, you know, all the way up to October 23, was that Iran managed to step by step expand its influence in the region. There was a point, actually, not long ago, it was in early 2024, that Yahya Rahim Safavi, who's a senior advisor to the Iranian supreme leader, I don't know if he still is or not, but he was an advisor to Ali Khamenei. He said something very interesting. He said that for the third time in history, we, the Iranians, have reached the shores of the Mediterranean. The first time it was Cyrus the Great. The second time it was Xerxes. And now we are once again with the help of Hezbollah on the shores of the Mediterranean. So when you you know, delve deep into the strategic narrative, which is, of course, the main focus of my work, you see that throughout all these years, and especially we can say that gradually after the Islamic Revolution, ideology, and probably after the death of Ruhollah Khomeini, ideology itself became a tool for regional expansionism, and also this kind of an idea of a forward defense as it is presented and perceived by the Iranians. So in the sense that, to put it in a nutshell, the forward defense, which was very much motivated by the experience of the war with Iraq, says that in order to preserve the mainland, we have to essentially create buffer zones, you know, in neighboring countries to increase our strategic depth. And the support for Iraqi militias, the support for Hezbollah, all that basically served this main purpose. So Iran became a power that was in a position that it could challenge Israel. And that, combined with the rhetoric from the more hardline ideological elements within the system. At some point, we had Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, for example. This whole crisis somehow intensified after Ahmadinejad reiterated Ruhollah Khomeini's words about, you know, Israel being wiped off the map or whatever it was. And we have it in this neorealist school of thought in the literature, right? When there is the capacity, like the kind of material capabilities, and then there's also the willingness to act in an aggressive way. And also when the enemy is geographically close, these kind of lead to a rise in the threat perception on the other side. So these three elements basically led to what Israel considers as an existential threat. So the right question, I think, that's what I want to say, is not whether the ideology of the Islamic Republic is after the destruction of the state of Israel. The right question is what factors work together and contributed to this threat perception on the Israeli side, which is now kind of reversed. And in a sense, Iran is feeling the same things. And I can explain why, if you want.
Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like to some extent it is a classic story of what's called the security dilemma is in a way a more complicated concept than this. But it is to some extent a classic case of both sides doing things for largely defensive purposes, so far as they're thinking of it, that are perceived as offensive. And then you get this positive feedback cycle where you get more and more seemingly offensive stuff, kind of, and here we are. That's the broad pattern, right? I mean, it's fascinating the way, to some extent, this starts with Israel being seen as a tool of the U.S., which had occupied such a central narrative in the revolution itself. In other words, the U.S. is a Satan. But then once you get this positive feedback cycle going, you know, Same with World War One, right? That's the broad story.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, we can frame it like this. But then again, we have elements like Hamas, like before that it was PLO. So these armed groups / political factions, Palestinian, who had their own objectives, had their own history of fighting against Israel, their own idea of resistance, but then they also saw a patron, right, in the Islamic Republic. So as I said, the whole relationship again started as organic, and it had to do more with the leftist groups and also with groups like Mujahideen Khalq, and it had to do with Khomeini and the current kind of leadership structure. But then that support also contributed to this sense. So this is the way that it all evolved and developed into what we are seeing at the moment. But there is another element to this as well. Look, it also has to do with the view among the Iranian leaders that supporting the Palestinian cause and opposing Israel gives them credibility in the Muslim world, gives them more influence among the Arab and Muslim communities, and in line with this idea of Iran being the center of the Islamic world, as the Iranian leader perceived this, so it cannot be the center of the Islamic world without dealing effectively with the issue of Palestine, because it had already become a core issue here. That's the same reason, more or less, that despite the pragmatic contacts between Saudi Arabia and Israel, for example, Saudi Arabia has not yet normalized with Israel the way that some other countries like the UAE or Bahrain have, because the Saudis do have this claim of the leadership of the Muslim world. So these are all the complexities that we have to have in mind when thinking about and analyzing this whole Iran-Israel issue.
Okay, so I want to explore those complexities now and get into the actual construction of the axis of resistance, which is a lot of what your book is about, and the and the term proxy that I know you think is in some ways an oversimplification, and that's very relevant to the current moment, because like when people say, well, at some moment, Iran may activate the Houthis. Well, I don't know whether they can just push a button and do that. I don't know. I'm going to ask you about that kind of thing. But first, let me say that, as I said earlier, the structure of these podcasts is we do have a long discussion in public. Then we go into what's called overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. There's a link in the show notes. You can go to nonzero.org and click on this post and become a paid subscriber. Or if you don't want to do that, at least become an unpaid subscriber. But before we go into overtime, I just want to say to people again, your book, The Axis of Resistance, Iran, Israel, and the Struggle for the Middle East, available for pre-order now. It'll be out in a few weeks in the U.S. It's available already in the U.K. and Europe. And also, people should definitely follow you on Twitter if they're interested in how this war is unfolding and may unfold. Your Twitter handle is at Hamid Reza A-Z. So that's HamidRezaAz. Hamid, I really appreciate your agreeing to stick around and talk some more in overtime. So that's what we're gonna do now.